Okay. The title of this shiur, or lesson we're going to try and learn together, I'm trying not to lecture the whole time, that's not how I teach, it's called, it's a very long title, Extending Acts of Chesed to the World, Seeing Chesed Through the Lens of Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Okay, a little bit of a mouthful. But on one leg, what we're going to try to learn today is, we have many acts of chesed, and we're first going to describe and explore exactly what that means. And it's in the context of mitzvot, and how we can extend those mitzvot beyond the Jewish community, and why it's important to have a mechanism that is framed within halacha, but also has some degree of permanence. So we're going to see how that works in a second. So let's take a step back, and we're going to just basically look at what chesed means, at least from a legal standpoint, before we look at anything else. Otherwise, the rest of it will not make any sense whatsoever, and that's not going to be good at all. Okay, so I want to take a look in the materials, in your handouts. If you look at source number 4, it comes from the Rambam Mishneh Torah. And so you have to understand, the idea of the Mishneh Torah is the Rambam kind of recodifying, reordering to a certain extent, Jewish law, putting it into a simple, well, not so simple, but a very logical framework, and explaining, first and foremost, what kind of mitzvah it is, where do we get it from, and what are the particulars of that mitzvah. Okay. So if I said to all of you, have you heard of the ideas of gemilut chasadim? Right? Does that sound familiar to everybody? And you would probably translate it as what? Acts of loving kindness. Okay. Now, when you look at them, and we'll see some idea of what that might entail, they're all very nice, but the term is a little bit misleading, because they're acts of loving kindness. But why do we do them? Do we do them because they're nice? Well, they are, for the most part. I don't think you're going to disagree with the list. The problem is you have to think of gemilut chasadim as a subset. If I had a board, I would draw a big circle, a subset of all the 613 mitzvot. So we don't do them necessarily because they're nice. We do them because they're mitzvot. And so if they're mitzvot, what if you don't feel like doing it? Too bad. Too bad. You're out of luck. You're out of luck. And so that's exactly what the Rambam tells you immediately. Mitzvah aseh shel divrehem. These are positive commandments. This is how he starts almost every single paragraph. When he starts every single mitzvah, he tells you, is it a positive commandment? Is it a negative commandment? Is it bein adam l'chaveiro, which these are all going to be, or bein adam l'makom? Shel divrehem. So he's going to categorize it. Okay, so we know it's a mitzvah to say, shall divrehem according to their words. Which words are we talking about? Whose words?
The rabbis.
The rabbis. Okay, so it's derabbanan. As opposed to it being deoraita, having an explicit directive in the Torah. And so when we look at the list, we'll cut to the chase a little bit. One, the list is visiting the sick. Do we have an explicit directive in the Torah that says, thou shalt visit the sick? No. We learn it. Well, we learn it actually from a Kosh Baruch Hu. Kosh Baruch Hu comes and visits Abraham. Okay, so we learn, but it's certainly derived from the Torah, but there's no explicit directive where you have for other things. Okay, so let's look at what he says. Shel divrehem levaker cholim, you're going to visit the sick. Ulenachem avelim, you comfort the mourner. And then we have a lot of things that have to do with taking care of the actual dead body and bride and groom. Let's see, Hanait. You're going to take out the dead body. Remember, in ancient times, the person would die at home and they would have to have someone remove it from the home. It wasn't in a hospital. You're going to escort the kala. This is haknasat orchim, but actually more than just inviting them in a home, making sure they have safe passage after you leave. Take care of everything that has to do with burial. And this means to carry on one's shoulder and to walk before them and to give a eulogy and to dig and then eventually to bury. And then also to gladden the bride and the groom and take care of all of their needs. Okay, so this is the list. This is the general list. What's missing? Something's missing. If you think of nice things that we do for other people.
The poor.
Well, specifically,
helping.
Like tzedakah. Okay. Tzedakah has functions in a completely different way and gets a whole section unto itself. So you can certainly include it in the acts of gemilut chasadim, but because the dynamic is a little bit different, it's not gladdening a bride and groom, it's restoring somebody back to where they should be. Its dynamic is different and it's so important it gets a whole other section. But you can certainly fold it in here. What do you notice about this list?
The thing that I noticed is that you don't expect any payback.
Okay. Certainly for the dead person, that's why we call it the chesed shel emet. It's the most truest of chesed, because the dead person is not going to write you a letter afterwards and say, that was a fantastic hesped you gave me, and I'm doing very well on my way to Gan Eden. That's just not going to happen. Okay. But you have a lot with the bride and the groom and the mourner. What's the connection between bride and groom and mourner? Psychologically.
Life cycle.
Well, you got a lot of life cycle. So what is it? How's the what kind of psychological position is the mourner in, besides being sad?
A passage in life
where they're in a precarious position, right? And also with someone who's getting married. Okay, you've heard the idea of cold feet. I mean, this is nothing new. Nothing new. Apparently, during the Ramadan's time, people had cold feet then as well. Okay. All right. And so you see, it takes care of everything, definitely life cycle, birth to death, all those kind of things. Okay. And he says very nicely for us how, and then he tells you what kind of mitzvah is, where it derives from, what the list is, and how you should do it. Okay, the Elohein Gemilut Chasadim, these are the acts of loving kindness, Shebegufo She'en Lahem Shiur. There is no set measure, which can mean one of two things. One thing is, let's say in your lifetime you have to do certain mitzvot, let's say you go to one wedding, can you cross that off your list and never have to go to another one again? No, it's not going to happen. You will never do them enough, and you should do them the very best that you can, Begufo, meaning with yourself. It's not rent a mourner and not rent someone to go to somebody else's wedding to Mesameach Tachatan and Kala. You got to do it yourself. Okay. Now, what's interesting is he considers these to be so important, and they're derabanan. Now, if they're derabanan, it doesn't mean that they're as important, but as far as legal weight, if they are deoraita, then we've really got something that you really cannot, there's no way around it. So what he does is he does something very interesting. He says, Af al pi shekol mitzvot elu midivrehem, even though all of these we are derived from the Chachamim, harei hen bichlal, but they really could be folded in or put into the klal v'havta l'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. And we're going to take a look at that in a second. So what does that mean? V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, just briefly, let's say we just translate it, love your neighbor or your fellow as yourself. Does that mean that I write a letter of undying love to my neighbor, who I love to swim in her pool and it's fantastic? She'll probably call the cops and have me arrested as some sort of crazy stalker. No, that's not what you do. You say, how do you show your love to another person? It's two things. You show the love to the other person by performing these acts of chesed, but remember that they're mitzvot, because when they're mitzvot, you're not only doing something nice for somebody else, you're reaffirming your connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what I want you to think about is chesed means loyalty. So we do these nice things. How do you show? The Chachamim will tell you, in many other parts of certainly in the Gemara, at the last section of Masechet Makot, they talk about this a lot. Those mitzvot that you do for another person might be the most important mitzvot that you do, because that's what the Kadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do. In other words, you need to get it right down here before you even start to talk to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Try to get it right. You want to get it right. Get right with the people on earth. And so he tells you in the end, he's going to fold it into this mitzvah, which we're going to go back and look at in a second. He said, Kol ha-devarim she'ata rotzeh she'yasu otam lecha echeirim, and then he ends by saying something that's kind of like the golden rule. Well, everything nice that you like to do for you, you should do to somebody else. But unlike the golden rule, which requires reciprocal, which is what we don't have here, do you have to make up what you want? You know, what I want for me might be very different what you want for yourself. It might be totally different. Do you have to make up what that is? No. Where are we going to get the ideas of how to be nice to somebody else? Are we going to have to make it up every single time? No, where are we going to look? Torah is going to tell us. Okay, so, chesed as a legal construct, it's a mitzvah. It reaffirms our loyalty to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's important in a sense, but it's couched in, he couches it into this very important pasuk that all of you know. So if you look at source one, in Vayikra we have this very, very popular pasuk, lo tikom v'lo titor, b'nei amecha v'havta l'recha kamocha, ani Hashem. Okay, so this is in Vayikra. You should now take a vengeance or bear a grudge against your countrymen. Love your fellow as yourself. I am Hashem. So already from Rambam gives us an idea of what it means v'havta l'recha kamocha. But there's a little issue. The little issue is, who are mitzvot for? How does it work? Who is commanded to do the mitzvot?
We are.
Meaning
Jews,
let's be specific. Are non-Jews commanded to do mitzvot?
It's seven.
All right, we're going to talk about the seven in a second, okay? But mitzvot in general?
No.
You're right. Right? Okay, and who's the recipient? When it says, Ben Adam l'chaveiro, which chaveiro are we talking about?
A Jewish
person. So, we already see how it's a little bit limited. Meaning, if the Rambam is going to tell you these acts of chesed are going to be folded in v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, what's the scope? Who can you do these mitzvot for?
Other Jews.
Only. Okay, hold on. Yeah.
Okay, I want to know where you get the only.
We're going to see in a second. Because this is what bothers the Chachamim. This is how the Chachamim, just to cut to the chase, the Chachamim we're going to see in the Gemara know that this is the case, and they're bothered by it. And they have to figure out a way to get around it. They don't like it. They don't like it at all. Okay. So at the next, skip to source number three. Source number three just gives you an idea that obviously this is a very important call, but it's limited because it only applies to Jews. And this is a discussion in the Yerushalmi. Rabbi Akiva Omer Zeh Klal Gadol BaTorah. Everybody knows it. You can start singing the song. This is all your kids will know the song. But there's another half of that part from the Yerushalmi. Ben Azai Omer Zeh Sefer Toldot Adam Zeh Klal Gadol Mizeh. He picks a pasuk from Breishit, which describes basically in so many words, we're all children, God created all human beings, can't we all just get along? As a greater klal. And there are pros and cons to both. V'haftareh kamocha is, there are pros and cons to it. The con is, we already see, it's a little limited because it only applies to Jews, for Jews, by Jews. That's how the dynamic works. And zeh klal gadol b'Torah is certainly more sweeping. But because it's more sweeping, there are not as many particulars of what your behavior should be. It's more of like an idea. Okay, now, we already know who won. Who won the argument here? Even though it says Ben Azai said that his was greater. Which one do you know? I promise you know V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. I don't think any of you are singing the Zeh Sefer Toldot HaAdam. Okay, might make a nice song, but I just don't think it's coming. So you can see already that we have some limits. Now, if we look at our list that we have from the Rambam, how do we think about these mitzvot? Are they good? Did they sound good? They sound good for a community to function in a proper way. Yeah, I don't think anybody has any trouble with these mitzvot. And but the tension that you see in that little snippet from the Yerushalmi is what's really bothering the Chachamim. The Chachamim are bothered by the fact that we have one set of rules for one group of people and one set of rules for another group of people, especially when it comes to these rules that are really nice for other people. And these are really fantastic. We have something to offer. But we're kind of limited. And so there's some discussions in the Gemara about this idea of, and we'll see specifically what this turns out to be, that we have a prohibition of extending some of legal constructs that would seem ethical and justifiable to those who are non-Jews. And so this is the problem. This is the problem. I'm going to read from a text that you don't have, but it starts to explain the tension that the Chachamim see in, like, this might not be so good for us, especially now that we're living in other places. We're living in Babylonia, we're living in Israel, but we're not in charge of our own destiny. And we believe we have a wonderful tradition, but this might cause conflict with the people around us. And they don't like it. They don't like it at all. And I'm just going to read one text that you don't have. In the Talmud Bavli, and this is in Baba Kama, and so if you know anything about the civil law, a lot of civil law in Jewish law has to do with property and your oxen and your cow and your donkeys and if you have pits, shor, boar, chamor, okay? One of my first days in law school in property had to do with fencing in and fencing out cows. And I called up my father. I said, shor, boar, chamor has followed me to law school. They're there. They haven't left. They're out there. So there is this very fascinating Agadah. So Agadah, is a piece in the Gemara, which is, it's a story. It's very nice if you're learning something extra, super legal to get the story, but it's not a story. It's a story to reinforce a moral rule or to show some sort of moral angst upon the Chachamim at the time. So they relate this story that the government of Rome sent some commissioners to go talk to the sages of Israel and said, teach us our Torah. And they said, well, they read it once, they read it twice, and it was fantastic. We thought the whole thing was fantastic, except until we got to this part in Shemot, which said that you're ruling that if an ox of an Israelite gores an ox of a Gentile, there's no liability. Whereas if an ox of a Gentile gores an ox of an Israel, whether this was an ox that had gored once or a couple times, compensation is paid in full. So they thought the entire Torah was fantastic because they're focusing on this one thing that seems to be a little bit of inequality in the law. In other words, if you have an ox, if it's a Jewish ox, you're going to get, you'll have restitution, it'll be fantastic if it's a non-Jewish ox. Now, we don't have to worry about the particulars of the case, but this is what's bothering them. This is what's bothering them. It's like, you know, we have two standards of law here, and maybe this is not such a good idea. Maybe we can figure it out. I'm just going to give you the end of the story. And they say, well, if on the other hand the implication of his neighbor does not need to be insisted upon, why even in the case... they have the Roman guys, I'm just going to summarize here, the Roman guys kind of saying, well, don't worry, you know, why do you have this inequality in the law? Now, the end of the story is most telling. At the end of the story, they tell the sages, well, but don't worry, we're not going to report this to the government. Okay, so what's the point? The point is basically saying, you know what? Well, we're not, it's really reflecting the angst of the Chachamim. It has nothing to do with the Romans, these Roman guys, whether they came or not. They're living in this society, and they know they seem to have this kind of double standard, which is bothering them. Bothering them. That's why at the end of the story, the guys don't report it. You know, they don't get in trouble for it. That's kind of, you get a little takeaway. So the question is, well, we live in these societies. We have these, you know, let's say we have a natural disaster. All the human beings in our situation are going to be taken care of. But if we can only extend those acts of chesed of taking care of people who are only our own, that might not be such a great idea within our communities. But we have halacha constraints. And what that chesed is, I'm constrained by Jewish law. So what do I do? Okay. So now...
an obligation to help Jews, that by itself does not necessarily indicate that it's asur to do the
Well, okay. It doesn't necessarily mean it's asur, but when we're going to see some particulars of many mitzvot, whenever it talks about any mitzvah that has to do with you and your reyah, it's usually something nice, like hashavat aveda we're going to see. Okay, so return it's you're going to see what that tension is. So it almost borders on asur. It almost borders on asur. So it limits the scope of what that can be. So we're going to see now some approaches. I'm obviously biased towards one, which is in the title, what I think is halachically is better. But it's just to see how the Chachamim were bothered by this and what they were trying to kind of work around this. What are we going to do? So one of it is, if you take a look at source number 5, and source number 5, we have a discussion in the Talmud. Rabbi Bavai, the son of Gidel, quoting Rabbi Shimon Chasida, says, property stolen from a Gentile is prohibited, his lost object is permitted. Okay. There seems to be some sort of discrepancy about when you can take property from a non-Jew. Okay. And they're learning this from specific directives in the Torah. So let's take a look what it is. His stolen property is prohibited. How do we know this? Because we see in the Torah, it says, you will consume all the peoples which the Lord your God is giving you. That's in Devarim. This is the directive when they go into Eretz Yisrael. They're going to have to consume them. When they are given over to your power during war, then you may consume them and take their money. But afterwards, if they agree to your demands to live in a moral society, then no, you can't take it anymore. In other words, they almost have a status as you. You can't steal their property. Okay. And his lost object is permitted, meaning the mitzvah that we have for Hashavat Aveda, we're going to see, because it contains the term Chavercha or Reyecha, is going to be limited. So what do they say? Rav Chama, the son of Guria, quoting Rav, says, where is it found in the Torah that the lost object of a Gentile is permitted? Because it says, for every lost object of your brother. Brother, and I'm going to just read exactly what it is. Okay. Of your brother. Okay. So if it's just your brother, what brother are we talking about?
Just a Jewish brother.
Okay. So, but this is still bothering them. They say, okay, but maybe we can find a way to do this. Because how's this going to work in a society? How's it going to work in a society when they say, oh, those Jewish people, they'll only do this fantastic thing of returning lost objects for their own, but not for anybody else. Okay. So this is approach number one. Okay. And it says, but you do not return them to a Gentile. It was taught, Rav Pinchas, the son of Yair, says, where there is desecration of the divine name, b'makom sheyesh chilul Hashem, afal pe avidehu asur. Even then, his object is prohibited. You have to return it to him. Okay. So how would you describe this mechanism? How are we now extending this lovely concept of returning lost objects, which sounds great. It's great for society, and personal property is important. How is it going to be extended according to this Gemara?
If it causes animosity between the Gaim and us, then we should return our object.
But it's actually even smaller. It's even not even just animosity. Who are we concerned about here? Whose reputation are we concerned about?
Hashem.
Hashem. Okay, so this is what I've called, we are here, this is from the point of view that when we accepted B'rit, it was not only just to have especially Abraham, when he accepted the B'rit, it was not only that he was going to follow in the ways of Hashem, but he was God's number one PR agent. He's a PR agent, and he's supposed to spread what this important and the best way to live is this Torah life. You know, Oprah Winfrey always says, live your best life. Well, his live your best life was follow God. Everything's fantastic. So what is he saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Like, well, you know, if we have two standards here, they're going to curse you out, God. They're going to say, what kind of God is this? Or what kind of religious way of life is this? This is bad. And they're going to curse you because we are in charge of God's reputation. And this will cause the desecration of your reputation. Okay, and it's one of our main jobs. We are God's PR agents. Okay, it's something to think about. Yeah.
Question: do the Chachamim ever discuss it as a question of morality, or
yes,
right and wrong?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. 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 So, as you can see, they do. I call this "What would the Goyim think?" And personally, I don't like this approach.
Right.
Okay. Not that I'm not concerned.
It's about me.
Well, it's also I'm not. Not that I'm. You know. Heaven forbid you think I don't care about God's reputation. I do. But there's a problem with this. Because the problem is, what if you're living around people who hate you? Who are already desecrating God's name? What's the impetus for you to extend the rules to them? Zero. 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 It depends on the time and place. Okay? If it doesn't matter, then, you know, the incentive is gone. So you talked about animosity. So the next source, it comes again from the Talmud Bavli. It says, okay, this is a very general statement. Okay, Tanu Rabbanim, Mefarnesim, Aniyei Nochriim, Im Aniyei Yisrael, Mekarvim, Cholei Nochriim, Im Cholei Yisrael, Bekovrim, Mitei Nochriim, Im Mitei Yisrael. Okay, there's a very general statement. We provide support for the poor of the Gentiles along with the poor of Israel, and we visit their sick, and we bury their dead. And what's the reason? Mipnei Darchei Shalom. Okay. So the first one is Kiddush Hashem, okay, and the next one is Darchei Shalom, for the ways of peace. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. What's the problem?
It's not about right and wrong. That's what I'm looking for.
Right. If for a legal construct, it's really weak. So is the first one. And it could also depend on what kind of situation you're living in. If you're living around people who are going to kill you, you know, I'm not, you know, forget it. So they come up with something else. They're going to reboot and shift it over and give you a different way of looking at it, and I'm obviously very biased towards this approach, and maybe it's because I'm a lawyer, but maybe it's just because it's something that has a little bit more teeth, a little bit more weight. Whereas ways of peace are, it's certainly a wonderful idea, and not to desecrate, you know, to make sure you don't do a chilal Hashem. These are nothing's bad about it, but as far as legal weight, it's a little lacking. So I want to take a look at, let's go to the Meiri first. Meiri was a 13th century scholar. And he is bothered again. This is the ox has come back. Okay, the ox is still around, and the ox has come back. And he said, you know, I'm looking at that part in the Torah, which is Shmot, and he's taking a look at it, and it's chapter 21, Perek Chaf of Shmot. I said, you know, I want to see this in context. Okay, so this is his drash, so to speak. I want to see this in context because he's living in 13th century. He's living among whom? He's Christians. Okay? Christians is this kind of pro-crusade. Okay? Things are looking up. Okay, things are looking up. And he's living around people with a very constrained religious tradition. Okay, so here he says here, in his discussion here, this is his commentary on the Gemara. I said, okay, here we go again. The ox of an Israelite which gored the ox of a Gentile, the owner is exempt from the lawsuit of his companion, the Gentile there, but that ox of a Gentile which never gored before or gored seven times, he pays the full cost of damages. Okay, so the Gentile has to pay the most. The difference is because, now he's going to make a very big statement here, it's going to sound to some of you a little offensive, but let's just see in context, do not care about other people's money. Therefore, we penalize them so that they do not accustom themselves to inflicting damage. Yet according to what is stated in the Gemara, which is what he's quoting, this rule applies specifically to the nations which are not constrained by the ways of religion and morals. So when it's talking about a non-Jew, in the biblical context, who are we talking about? Are we talking about people who have a moral system? No. Okay? So when you think about idol worshipers, you know, in a biblical context, you have to think of it as something, not just someone who's bowing down to a statue, but you know, someone who has no regard for personal property or personal space or sacrificing their children, everything that's pretty awful, even in today's light, for the most part, until as of now, murdering and sacrificing your children is still considered to be something bad. Not that we don't feel like we want to kill our children some days, but okay, whatever. So, okay, all right, so he went at, so notice when he says here, the nations are described in the Gemara, when God saw that the idolaters, meaning, did not fulfill even the 7 mitzvot which the children of Noah accepted upon themselves, he went ahead and released their money, as long as the law finds them deserving of this. Okay, so what's the template? The template is, you can have an equal system of law when you're dealing with people who are the same moral page. How are you going to figure out if they're on the same moral page? What's your template going to be? The Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Now, this is not a lecture necessarily on the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. That's a whole other 5-day seminar. But just to keep in mind that the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach were given to the world for everybody. And according to many Chachamim, especially the Rambam, everyone is obligated. The entire world is obligated to fulfill these mitzvot, even today. Doesn't matter what the tradition is. For us, until we got the Torah, essentially we were just B'nai Noach. That's all we got. Okay. So that's all we had specifically. Okay. And so let's read the last part. This implies that whenever they do observe the 7 mitzvot, their legal status with respect to us is the same as our legal status with respect to them. And we must not favor ourselves in matter of law. And given this is the case, it goes without saying that the equality holds true for the people constrained by the way of religion and morals. Okay, so let's now take a look at the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach and see what his lens is. And then let's put it in a greater context. Okay, this comes from your source number 7. Let's take a look at them. Tana Rabbanan, Sheva Mitzvot, Nitzavu B'nei Noach. Okay, they were charged with 7 mitzvot. Okay. Dinin, establishing courts of law. Abir Chat Hashem, blasphemy. It's not to do blasphemy, but not to do blasphemy. Not to do idolatry. Not to have sexual crimes, specifically incest and adultery. That's what's fleshed out. Bloodshed, not to do it. Theft, obviously. And not to eat the limb from the live animal. And that's the one that's the most specific, because when Noah comes out of the ark, after he gives his sacrifice, he's given a directive that's very similar to what Adam and Chava were given, except a couple things. Adam and Chava were only allowed to have, were essentially vegetarians. Noah is allowed to eat meat, but again, as in most laws, not every time, every place, everywhere, there's some limits. You have to wait until the animal is clearly dead. Okay. If you turn on Animal Planet right now, there's some poor zebra being eaten alive by a lion. Okay. And that's really, that hones home the idea of Eiver Min HaChai. Know, wait until it's dead. Some degree of that. Okay, let's take a look at this. What do these look like? Or what do these sound familiar to you in our tradition? Look at the Ten Commandments, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so establishing courts of law. We don't have that as a specific one of our commandments, but we do have something that has to do with being in a court. Which one?
False witness.
False witness, exactly. You can't have a false witness unless you have a court system. Okay, so that's one. Why is that first?
Establishes the basis and foundation.
Right. It's very nice to have rules if you have no mechanism to enforce it. You know, they're very lovely ideas. Good. Blasphemy. And blasphemy is the idea of denying the existence of God. Denying the existence of God, that becomes a problem. It doesn't mean that you can't necessarily have other gods. I mean, this is a big, big debate among the Chachamim, which modern religions could be considered idolatry or not. We're not going to talk about that. But it's denying the existence of our God. Of our God. Okay, so the best way to think about it is like Paro. What's the problem with Paro? Why is his heart hard on one idea? Is because he considers himself a God. And the only one. So that makes it the worst. Okay, idolatry. That could be hard, but I think a better way to think about it is not so much praying to another god, but engaging in activities to that god, which even today we would consider to be reprehensible, especially sacrificing your children. You have all these directives in the Torah. You should not offer your children to Molech over and over and over again. That seems to be the quintessential bad news kind of idea for idolatry. Okay?
I have a question about blasphemy and idolatry. if someone believes in other gods, then they're violating idolatry.
Well, no, as I, it's not so much, not in that sense. Idolatry is not so much the denying the existence of God, but engaging in activities towards that other god that are morally terribly reprehensible. That's why I brought up the idea of Molech.
That was taught differently.
There are many different opinions. Yeah. Many different opinions.
So that's how, like Christians, so some of them believe that Beshki's a god, and some of them don't. So then, like, we're allowed to go into a mosque, but we're not allowed to go into a church.
But it depends on who you follow. The Meiri would let you go into a church, no problem.
So I was taught that we're not, unless they don't subscribe to
it depends.
As a god.
The Meiri would let you go into the French Catholic Church, no problem. At all. So it depends. A lot of it depends on where you sit. Okay?
Because it seems that, according to what I learned, it seems that we are asking the Goyim to be monotheistic.
Well, or not so much to be monotheistic, but not to deny our tradition.
What tradition?
Denying our belief in the one God. Okay, so there's a little bit of a difference. It's a little.
You can't believe in one God if you believe in other gods.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
No.
Right. But it's not belief. It's behavior. All of these are behavior. Look at these. They're all behavior.
Okay,
I said, no. It's all behavior. And they would say it was one God. It would depend on who you talked to. As far as Christianity, it would be one God. I mean, it's interesting that some would say you can go into a mosque. Some would say you can't go into a mosque because Muslims deny that our Torah is true. They think our Torah is a fake. And they didn't, and they denied Brit.
I've heard that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But Yishmael had a bris.
But the Brit goes through Yishmael, not to Yitzchak, and that's a big problem.
I know. I lived in Israel, and I went to a religious girls' school, and they did take us into a mosque.
Right. So it depends. I mean, there's a various opinions. But think of it as behavior as opposed to belief. Mm-hmm. Like behavior, and that's a better way to look at it because these are directives for behavior. We have very few mitzvot, even for us, that are just belief. And even when they are belief, even if it's some sort of, it's always tied to some sort of behavior all the time, almost all the time. Okay? All right, so let's look at sexual crimes. Again, this is behavior, bloodshed, theft, eating. Okay, so we have blasphemy, idolatry, sexual crimes. We certainly have that in the Aseret HaDibrot. Okay? Bloodshed, murder, that's absolutely there. Theft, that's there. And the last one, it certainly was incorporated into our kashrut laws. Okay, it's not the first thing, but it gives you an idea of kind of limiting. And what I would say that this template basically becomes is maybe like the bare minimum for a civilized society. Okay, whether they are believing in more than one God or not. Okay, so what it turns out to be is when the Meiri here makes that very strong statement, people who are constrained by the way of religion and morals, at least an understanding that if you're living some sort of religious tradition properly and not corrupted, then you will be restrained and you'll make this test. Okay? And not to be hung up on those details, which means that if you're living in a society with people who are living among you who are following this standard, and maybe even more, he's telling you that these people have more. People have religion, in his experience as Christians, they not only have Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, but they have that plus. Then, of course, we can have a conversation with them and we can help each other out and we can certainly extend those mitzvot to other people when you're living in that society. If you are living in total hefkeiros, well, you know, perhaps take care of your own first before you work at it. And the interesting thing about it is that this template is why I like it better, because as a legal construct, it's something that is more eternal and certainly has a little bit more brass tacks. You can take a look at it. And it doesn't necessarily mean if you're living in a situation where people are bad or what the history is, you can just say, okay, what group of people am I dealing with? Do they have this bare minimum standard? And not only that, he's not telling you that you can, he's telling you that you must. You must do it. So it's very, very different. Okay, the idea is now you have the obligation. In other words, in the same way that you have the obligation to do those acts of chesed for Jews, when you're in those situations and they're making this standard, you have the obligation to do so. And if you don't, you are going to be doing an aveira in the same sense if you would do it if you weren't going to extend it to a non-Jewish person. So it lifts it up. When you use this template, at least from my small point of view, gives it a lot of legal weight and also extends the obligation. I think the other thing that's important to understand is that people who have this, especially with religion, when you're dealing with people who understand the idea of obligation, you can have a conversation with them. You can have a conversation with them. Someone who's obligated in the way that they live their life to live the best life for other people, then you have you, then you really then you can have that kind of conversation. And you don't even have to talk about philosophy, but it's just how you take care of other people, which is Zeklal Gadova Torah. That's extended. Yeah.
Wasn't the really the first major rabbinic authority to express this?
Yes, yes, yes. And
it was like, what, 14th?
13th century. 1200, but 13th century. And it certainly, the Rambam struggled with this a lot. You know, he was a little bit more enamored with Islam because he lived his life in Islamic countries. He lived in the Muslim Spain and Egypt, etc. Okay. And he had a little bit harder time with Christianity. Part of it is just that wasn't part of his experience, necessarily. In the end, he debates whether they're idolatry or whether they're bad, and then he kind of, at the end of Mora Nebuchadnezzar, kind of says, well, but you know what? They give these people a way to live a better life, and so when Mashiach comes, and the real God comes, they'll have a framework, and they'll understand what he's talking about. So that he's leading them to the right path. It's okay. It's okay. It's a path that's on the... They're on the right track. They're on the right track. And so we can have a conversation. But someone without this, you really can't have a conversation.
What about prioritization? So it's just like there's so much resources, right, that we have. So in other words, if we're making organizations to help our community, it's like, well, how much resources do we have? So even though we may have some obligation towards the Gaon and nothing against them, we do have to take care of our own first.
And they have the same responsibility to theirs. They have the same responsibility.
So isn't that like something to think about?
Oh, absolutely. And then you see that priorities, and especially the Rambam, when he talks about tzedakah, tells you how to prioritize even within your own family.
Yeah.
And right. Elucidates it very, very clearly.
Right.
That truly charity begins at home, even before you even go to your outside your house.
Right.
So that's how it goes. All right, so I only have like 3 seconds or something. What I wanted to end with all this is very nice. Theoretical, but I think it's something to consider. I had two examples. One I gave to you, another one I have here. When there was that horrible earthquake in Haiti in 2010, the only people who came and who actually had their act together was the Israeli Field Hospital. And actually, we have a cousin who is a pediatric plastic surgeon from Florida, and he went down to do surgery there, and he said, yeah, it was just amazing. Like, nobody else knew what to do. The Israeli Field Hospital in Haiti was fantastic. And moving on, and it was just, what was interesting about it is, even though Jewish law informs some part of Israeli foreign policy, it's a suggestion, it's not part of the policy, but it was just kind of the way that they went about it, the way that the Israelis do it. You know, they're not asking for fanfare, they just kind of do it, because this is what we do. This is what we do. We are obligated to do so. There's some, you know, the doctors might say, like, I'm going to have to do it because I'm obligated to do it. But sometimes you do have situations where someone who is a Jewish person will say, I'm doing this because I'm required to do this. And that's what I want to end with. It was the great story of Mr. Feuerstein, okay? Aaron Feuerstein, okay, who wins the Kiddush Hashem Award, I think, for all time. I mean, you know him. He made Malden Mills, the Polartec Fleece Company, and the whole thing burned to the ground. And he decided to pay his workers. And he got death threats from this, and it was really terrible. And what was interesting is not only that he was a Jewish person who did this. You know, whenever we see something bad in the paper, that someone has done bad, what do we look for? We look at the name, like, oh, you know, if it's a Cohen, we're like, oh, if it's O'Brien, all right, maybe not so terrible. Okay, at least it wasn't us. So Feuerstein, not only is he a Jewish person, he's involved in the Jewish community in Boston. My brother-in-law, I think, had Shabbos dinner at his house one time. Carmi did, it was one of those kind of things. But the reason is he publicly stated why he did this. And this was the most important part. If you just see at the end, the reason why he did this, it cost him a lot of money, as it would cost him $300 million in assurance settlement and another additional loan of $100 million. His decision he credits to his belief in Jewish law, which prohibits oppressing the working man who is poor and needy, and because he's considered a brother. Okay. Now, these weren't Jewish workers. You know, you do have to pay your workers on time, and it doesn't specify, that's in the Torah, it doesn't specify exactly who that is, just whoever your worker, but he says, ah, these are people, they're working hard, they're leading a decent life, they are like me, I have to extend them. And the reason why he's saying is, I had to do it, because I'm obligated to do it. Not because it's a nice thing to do, not because it's a good thing to do, because I'm an obligated person. And when I see this in context, and these decent people, I had to do these acts of mitzvah of chesed. Not an act of chesed. It is. It's an action. But it's a mitzvah. I'm obligated to do it. And so why does this become a Kiddush Hashem? What better way to show his loyalty to a Kodesh Baruch Hu than doing this? Okay. I don't know, this wins for me every single time. it just wins. I'm just sorry that many times people will do nice things, they want to be quiet about it, but here was someone who said, yeah, it's not just because I'm a Jewish person who happened to do something nice. I follow Jewish law, and Jewish law says I have to do this. Why? Because I'm living with these people. Now, you could also say he did it because he didn't want to desecrate God's name, or it was for the ways of peace. But I think it was something bigger going on here. He saw decent people working in the community, and he understood that his requirements to do acts of chesed extend to them, even beyond the idea of, he went way beyond the employer-employee relationship, even within Torah. So, but that, any, if you have any questions or whatever, okay, I have to press this button now.